evening and welcome to Town Square. As always, our conversations include you, and if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, our number is 941-3689. Use that number if you're on Oahu. And if you call us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream from someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Are you disillusioned with the status quo? Mufi Hanneman hopes so. His candidacy for governor stresses issues over party affiliation and, above all, people over party. His political career spans three decades, noted as much for the losses as the wins. He has had success in the Honolulu City Council and as the city's mayor, but the governor's office has so far eluded him. As you know, this time around, he's running as an independent, and although he's still a distant third, the Republican Governors Association has their eye on him. On Monday, they tweeted the link to the group's article, Ige and Mufi, More of the Same. Locally, while some count him as a spoiler, others are touting his presence in the race as a leveler and his performance in the debates as calm, smooth, and targeted. Tonight on Town Square, we continue our series of conversations with gubernatorial candidates. Mufi Hanneman joins us for the next hour. Welcome. Nice to have you back.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
In your performance during the debates, people began to look at you a little differently. And people who had been some of your fiercest critics in the past began to talk about you differently. Did you remake yourself for this, or have you just grown a little older or wiser?
Well, I think the fact that I've been able to articulate positions and views perhaps a little better than I have in the past. Secondly, I don't have the so-called baggage sometimes that comes upon you when you are a member of a party, like I've been in the past, where there's a lot of special interest groups, there's a lot of power brokers, if you will, that try to tend to influence how you think and what you say. And I feel very comfortable and very confident in what I'm doing here because, as I said, it's all about the people. It's not about what party agendas or party platforms try to tell you or try to make you do or not do. And therefore, I think it's coming across very clearly, and I really believe in this election we are providing a strong alternative, a strong choice to the same old, the way people have voted in the past and the same results that have happened in the past with a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislator or a Republican governor and a Democratic-dominated legislator. We're saying think independently, then vote independently. And why not someone who comes from a nonpartisan background like the city, albeit it was known I was a Democrat? But there, the emphasis is really doing what the people want you to do. I really believe that. And you're not encumbered by party caucuses or figuring out how you can get votes through by appealing to the Republican flank or the Democratic flank. It's just doing what's best for the people. And I believe that's how we were able to leave the city better than we found it. And as we go to the state, now more than ever, Beth, with the pressing problems and challenges facing us that has been around for decades, whether it's energy prices, our state hospital system, our education system. Here's an opportunity to have someone who can work with both sides, Democrats and Republicans, business and labor, and do what we need to do for you as opposed to do what we need to do to keep my party in power or to make my party topple the ruling party and therefore gain the majority.
Would there have been another time that you would have chosen to vote as an independent, or do you think this is a matter of timing that now independents are much more welcomed into the political scene?
You know, if you look at every survey that's been done, whether it's national or local, I think most people feel that they're independent. The feeling that I had about Hawaii is that I really believe that we had a sitting governor that I think was really in trouble. And therefore, I think this was a time to have real change in Hawaii. So the only way I felt you could do that effectively is to foster a third-party option as opposed to try to do it from within the Democrat or the Republican Party, because there are influences at work in both parties that will make it difficult to really speak what you want to do for the people and, more importantly, to effectuate change without, you know, rubbing people the wrong way or getting in the way of people who have been so used to having their way in the Democratic or the Republican Party.
But it would be naive to think that you can be totally and absolutely away from any sort of influence. How do you intend to shield yourself from some of those influences who may have very good ideas or very good ways of twisting arms to be able to get their positions known?
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. that's why I think I'm in a very unique position to carry this force, because at the city, I really did function in a nonpartisan way, and we led by example. So let's take the unions. I've never had a contentious relationship with them. And even when we disagreed, we always found common ground. And one of the things, as Les Chang would remember as my running mate, is when we knew that we'd have to ask the unions for a pay raise, a 5% pay cut, the next fiscal year, I told my cabinet, we're going to take it this year. And they would say, why are we doing it? We're already taking a pay cut. I said, because I want to lead by example. I want to make sure that they know that this is what we need to do. We all have to sacrifice. So management must lead. I had a situation where one of the public employee unions had great difficulty trying to do curbside recycling because the previous mayor tried to privatize that service. So I sat with them. I heard them out. And then I went to the people and said, you know, if we're going to be able to afford this, we can't do a third service in addition to the twice-a-week Opala pickup. We're going to have to reduce one of them to be able to implement curbside recycling. And so as you see today on Oahu, you now have once a week instead of twice a week Opala pickup. That second pickup has become curbside recycling. I sat down and worked it out with the union and said, okay, is this something acceptable? We're not going to privatize this service, but we need to do it. And that's what happened. So I feel that it's possible to work from the frame of an independent, because I have a track record, Beth, of doing that. Or take public-private partnerships, which has now become a buzzword amongst the gubernatorial candidates. I embraced that throughout my career, whether I was in the private sector or the public sector. Government cannot do everything on its own. And when I heard Duke Iona say a couple of times, government just needs to get out of the way and let business do its thing. And then when he heard me say public-private partnership to save state hospitals, he's now also saying that. I said, Duke, you can't have it both ways. Government has an appropriate role and has to be in play. But there are times where we're going to need private partners to come in, whether to save our state hospitals or move our needle in terms of our dependence on oil and embrace all renewable energies. I really think we need a public-private partnership to do that too. So I believe that I can, despite the fact I am an independent. The other thing I have, Beth, too, is a wealth of relationships on both sides. You know, having been born and raised here, I obviously know some Democrats for a long time. We have personal relationships that go back years. Folks that have moved here recently, I also have some good relationships there. And I really believe at the end of the day, my ability to work on both sides, and I think what I'm going to sell is, hey, look, this is a good idea. And I don't care who gets the credit at the end of the day that makes it happen. But if this is a good idea, let's find common ground. Let's look to compromise so that you're in it, I'm in it, and most of all, we're making sure we're addressing the needs of the people. This is what we need to do. And I think I have a number of issues I can point to that have been stagnant, that have been deadlocked, that if we've reached an impasse on, that we need to move forward on. And with our collaborative leadership skills, we can make it happen.
You just mentioned a couple of things, one that I want to ask you about, because you mentioned how when you're talking about public-private partnerships, and yes, that has become a buzzword along with collaboration and leadership, and we can write a whole list. But do you feel that you really massaging or shaping the conversation and focusing the attention of the electorate a little bit sharper and a little bit better because you have the ability to say anything because you are running in third place? Does that give you some sort of grace?
I think the freedom and flexibility of not being hunkered down by party platforms and the like, but I think what's also shown is the executive experience. And that's why I can speak very intelligently, very conversantly, and I think to a certain degree with a great amount of accuracy because I've been there. I mean, managing the resources of which some have called the 13th largest city in the United States, it's a far different set of skills than being a judge trying to make that transition or a legislator trying to make that transition. And so the proof in the pudding, as I like to say, is that there's a track record. Everything I've said during this campaign of what I'd like to do is based on what I've done in the past. And so I believe that's why it's very believable and credible, and I can speak intelligently on it because there was a certain process that I followed through. I remember I was the first one to say during the course of this campaign that the first thing a governor has to do is to choose a cabinet. All of a sudden, my two competitors started to talk about that, but they've never done it, and it's not that easy. What I did at the city was, you know, once again, playing the nonpartisan card, I hired Democrats, I hired Republicans, I hired independents, and I even kept some of Mayor Harris's people on board as carry holdovers, if you will. So the other night when I was asked in a debate, is there anything that Governor Abercrombie is doing that you would carry forth? I said a couple of things. I said three things. One, I said I like the natatorium, that particular issue, because that was something that I started, and Kurt Caldwell was my managing director then. That's a plan that we presented. Now the state is following through on that. I also said that the Department of Emergency Management, of which the state has now, and they put it through in place through a legislative process, was the same process that we went through in the city, where I renamed the Uvalde Civil Defense Agency the Department of Emergency Management, upgraded the directorship to a cabinet level, and been able to now to adapt to the policies of Homeland Security and everything else that we have to do from a civil defense standpoint. And then the third thing I said that caught a lot of people by surprise is I said, and I'm willing to consider members of Governor Abercrombie's administration that are doing a good job. I want to ask them to stay on. So one can only do that if you've been there. And I think for my competitor, that was such a novel thing for me to say, because you're used to taking the broom and cleaning it out.
Everybody, yeah.
Right. And I don't think that's necessarily true. Just because Governor Abercrombie lost badly to David Ige, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have good people there that were trying to do a good job.
When you talk about that part of the executive experience, creating a cabinet, you've been pretty clear about that. But what else do you see as part of the executive experience that you see lacking in both of your competitors?
Well, they haven't been in a position where they do a budget from an executive point of view. That's very different. As a legislator, it's all about cutting the budget. It's all about making sure that when that budget comes down, the first thing in your mind is, okay, this is a big budget, so let's make sure the budget that we pass out is smaller. And a lot of times you'll make cuts very frivolously or callously just to make sure that your budget is smaller than the mayor or the governor, or you redirect priorities without really thinking it through. A chief executive has to oversee many departments and agencies. A chief executive also has not only focus on cutting, but he also has to focus on growing the economy. So it's just like during the course of this debate, when I've been talking about growing the economy and they've been pointing to things that they've been doing, you know, it's not the same as a governor or a mayor or a president of the United States seeing it from a much more international perspective. The other two parts of the job that I think are very important is we no longer have Senator Inouye in Washington. He was our go-to guy. Whenever we wanted something from the county or the state, we'd check off with him. We have a very young delegation that in time will get influence and seniority. So that's another part that I brought to the table and have said in several forums. I have that background in Washington, having worked for four presidential administrations, two Democrats, two Republicans, and a proven track record when I was mayor in Honolulu and played a key role in securing some key votes to keep Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard open. And I think that's going to be very important for the next governor to be able to walk the halls of Washington, D.C. and get federal grants. The other part of it, too, if you want to grow the economy, is, you know, it's a no-brainer that person has to be able to reach out to the Asian Pacific region. We had an international forum, very interesting, Beth, a few weeks ago. David Ige has never traveled to any parts of Asia, at least in the record that day when we were talking about it, in an official government capacity. That's going to be a huge undertaking for the next governor to come in, because it's all about relationships. It's all about a proven track record. It's all about sister city, sister state relationships that you've had so that we can welcome investment from Asia here. And I think that if we look at our biggest industry, for example, with tourism, I'm advocating a visa waiver pilot program with China and Hawaii. And I put the emphasis on pilot because I don't think our country is quite ready yet to give a full-on visa waiver program for China and United States. But because I do business in the Asia-Pacific region, we do have a visa waiver program in place for Saipan, Commonwealth of Northern Mariana, where a Chinese visitor doesn't need a visa to go to Northern Mariana. Now, that's an American flag area. So I'm saying, why not advocate for a pilot program here? Let Hawaii be that test case, and based on the relationships that I have in the Department of State, Homeland Security, most importantly in dealing with tourism as I've had in the past, I think this would help bolster tourism significantly, and it's a good idea to put on the table, and it's worth pursuing, once again, because of my international experience.
For people who are in Hawaii and who are at a very median income, the standard of living and the cost of living and the way in which life flows here, albeit it sometimes can be frustrating and difficult, it's still something that they're willing to put up with to a certain point. That seems to be, though, on everybody's lips to a certain point, where a lot of people have express their own frustrations and their lack of willingness to put up with some of it any further. Everything that you've just said about tourism, about creating relationships outside of Hawaii to bring business to Hawaii, though, that's one man, and one man can't do it alone. How do you create a package of collaboration that addresses some of those cost of living and standard of living issues right now for people who are still hurting and who have not come out of what we saw happen 6 years ago, and for whom there really hasn't been a true recovery, despite what any of the folks in the financial community want to say about it?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to take care of business here at home. And my international agenda, I believe, will help us with some of the domestic changes we need here. So let's take housing, for example. I really believe the state has to be more of a facilitator than it's been in the past. We can't do everything. We get a lot of federal grants and incentives to address low-income housing. We have to do a better job of that. But it's that middle class that's hurting. Those who are very wealthy will always be able to afford what is the median range on Oahu, which is $750,000 plus. But it's that huge middle class, and that's what I want to do. I think we can do a better job by embracing public-private partnerships. We have a lot of private developers here who I believe with more government help in streamlining the permitting process, making sure if there's state land or state facilities available to convert into housing, we do that. The collaborative approach that I've called for as a governor in all the issues that we deal with is called the Hawaii Council of Leaders, where it's the governor and four mayors working on all our issues, whether it's homelessness, state hospitals, housing, as opposed to what has been done too much in the past where it's a silo. Governor does his thing or her thing, and then the counties are only called to come to the table when the governor needs a fifth vote for collective bargaining, because they need five votes for management's position. I want to do it totally collaborative across the board. Now, you may ask, why does he think that'll work? Well, when I was a first-year mayor, I approached Mayors Kim, the late Mayor Baptiste, and Mayor Arakawa, and I said to them, let's do it together. Let's form the Hawaii Council of Mayors. Let's work collaboratively. And they kind of looked at me and says, we're not used to that from a Honolulu mayor. It's usually the Honolulu mayor walks up front and we kind of trail from behind. And it's always Honolulu-centric. I said, well, I want to change it because I really believe that if we work together collaboratively, we'll all benefit. So now that model at the state level will be five minds are better than one. If the state prospers, the county will benefit. If the counties do better, the state will improve. So, Beth, I really believe whether it's housing, whether it's reducing the taxes, we have over 100 different taxes at the state level that's assessed of every individual, every business. I've called for a management review of all these taxes because a lot of them I don't think are going to the where it should be going in terms of a special fund, and I've been a stickler for that at the city level where you don't raid special funds. Or take the case of the conveyance tax, very important for the counties to get a sense of what that conveyance tax is, because that's how you set real property taxes. The conveyance tax is still done manually rather than electronically.
As are many things.
Right. So that doesn't make any sense to me. And I think we need to, get to the bottom of that and make sure that we're using technology for more accurate information so that we can reduce the paperwork, but most importantly, speed up those results and the figures to the county so that they don't have to threaten county residents every year that we may have to raise your real property taxes because enough money hasn't come in, or we're not getting our fair share of the hotel room tax because the state is holding on to it. And the bottom line there is that it's a raid on the hotel room tax because the lion's share of that money is going to the general fund. So these are practices that I want to bring into this job based on the fact that I did it as a mayor, but more importantly, I'm very committed to a collaborative approach. And I really believe whatever that issue is, if we do it collaboratively, we're going to find results a lot better than it's been in the past. And it's not going to be a situation where only one county is going to benefit from that approach. All the counties are going to benefit.
We're going to collaborate with some of our callers right now. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877 941-3689. Tonight, a conversation with Mufi Hanneman, and you're invited. Going now to Bill calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Bill. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello.
Hi there, Bill.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Hanlon about two things. He talked about public-private cooperation. Does he believe the public-private cooperation with Municipal Services Bureau in Texas, who collects our traffic fines, is an appropriate public-private cooperation?
Okay, and you had a second question?
I had a second question of if he intends to do any reforms to the Child Support Enforcement Agency and their proclivity to breaking up families and making children fatherlessness through incentive grants.
All right. We're going to talk about the first one first. Thanks very much, Bill. And if you would like to join us, we have open phone lines for you, too, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. He's looking for the nature of public-private partnerships and what kind of accountability if you have a private partner who is far away.
Well, let me talk about that specific issue. If any heartburn I've had in the past on the traffic fines is that a lot of that is collected by the city through our police officers and the like, but it goes to the state. The city or the counties don't receive a penny from that. And of course, the state's argument is that they need that because of the judiciary responsibilities that are at the state level rather than the county level. So I don't think a public-private partnership is needed there. I think what we need to do is figure out whether the state should continue to keep all of the traffic fines, moving violations that they currently basically have the city collect or the counties collect, I should say, in the case of the Big Island, and they keep it in its entirety. I'm talking more about the state hospital situation that you have there on the Big Island, where we're losing $165 million a year trying to keep all 12 state hospitals operating. You have a wonderful example in North Hawaii with Waimea.
Queens, yeah.
Yeah, North Hawaii, exactly, Beth, where Queens has come in, has purchased that hospital, and they're operating in the black. You have more doctors and specialists there are treating Big Island residents as opposed to referring them to Oahu. And the employees that Les Chang and I talked to recently are very happy. And you have what is called patient-centered healthcare. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like a public-private partner to come in to save our state hospitals because you have a major issue with Hilo. You have a major issue there in Kona. Kaiser Permanente has recently shown some interest in opening some clinics there on the Big Island of Hawaii. And what we need is a public-private partnership legislative measure to pass the legislature once and for all so that we can begin the process of discussions with the unions, with the private partner, with the community. Because part of that, too, as I like to see, is we need to address the shortage of doctors that we have in Hawaii. We have a shortage of 750 doctors.
And growing.
And growing. Yeah. And, you know, part of the challenge that we have is to incentivize or motivate that doctor who comes to Hawaii, perhaps from the outside or maybe graduated from University of Hawaii, to want to relocate to the neighbor islands and live there, raise their families, and practice their medicine there. And so that's a major, major problem. But if we're not graduating enough doctors, if we continue to cut funding for the University of Hawaii Medical School, which we've been doing over the years, and the Cancer Center, we're never going to get there. All we're going to do is exacerbate the doctor shortage problem. So we need to do a better job on that. On your second question, I think it really goes to the heart of, you know, making sure that whatever our policies are, that we provide for strong families. And if we have a situation where it's a single parent, another gender, we have to provide support. And a lot of times when you have broken homes or divorces that take place, we in government's got to be very sensitive to those issues there, making sure that we can make that person whole. I always believe in people need a second chance, even if they started off in life not treating their children properly, if they're willing to make restitution. We've got to be there to help them. And then we also have to have the right components from additional counseling that they might need or philanthropic foundations or social service organizations out there working collaboratively to make that happen.
I want to go back to an earlier part of what you were just talking about with public-private partnerships. Bill's question about an entity in Texas administrating some of this. Going back to sort of maybe the root cause of this, are you saying then that you like to see a private partner be someone in and of Hawaii and that we should be concerned about having a private partner that would be elsewhere?
No, not necessarily, Beth, but I think in this particular case, there's strong interest that's been shown from private hospitals, private nonprofit hospitals here in Hawaii.
You want to take a sip of that water for a second?
Yep. I'm talking a lot lately. And that's a concern that I have. There was a key measure that was moving through on public-private partnerships in the last legislative session, and there was a very interested partner at the table that wanted to purchase Maui Memorial. Well, they weren't able to go forward with their desires and their plans because we couldn't get a key bill that was stuck in committee to pass out of there and pass the full Senate and the legislature to enable that to happen. And to me, that was a missed opportunity because we knew someone was at the table that had strong roots here in Hawaii. Since then, we've learned that the same hospital on Maui now has another partner who's revealed themselves, and that's Kaiser Permanente. They want to purchase this. So you have two private hospitals in Hawaii that want to purchase Maui Memorial, but they can't move forward. They have to wait till next legislative session and hope that they finally pass a public-private partnership bill that will talk about and discuss how public employees are going to be treated in this transaction. And, you know, I don't like to point fingers at someone, but, you know, I had to say the other night, and Duke Iona said the same thing too, that Senator Ige was a key member of that conference committee as the Senate Ways and Means Chair. And the campaign that he touts is that he has, you know, a lot of power and influence in the legislature. Well, what could be more important, in my opinion, than trying to do something about our state hospital system, especially when we're losing $165 million a year, and it's all about patient-centered health care where people can go to a facility where they reside as opposed to being told, we've got to send you to Oahu.
And then much of what we have heard from him and from others is that when you have so many good issues on the table, something good is going to get cut too, in all fairness, that it's not just trying to single out the hospitals to 86 them.
Exactly. But when this issue has been around for decades, that's my problem. It's like
it's been around too long is what you're saying.
It's like the air conditioner problem.
With the schools.
What they did this past session is that the legislature said they want to study the problem again. The Department of Education has a priority list of where these air conditioners should be implemented. It just boggles my mind as adults. If we don't have air conditioning, we find it very difficult to work. For young students, for our kids, if they don't have air conditioning, how can you expect them to perform?
You're going to get no argument from a lot of the teachers and students who are out there protesting and trying to make their cases known. We've talked to many of them. If you'd like to join us, our phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight we're talking to Mufi Hanuman about the campaign, what he would wish for were he governor, and he's here also to answer your questions as well as mine. Going now to Cole, calling us from Maui. Aloha, Cole. Thanks for your patience.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well, thank you.
I really wanted to hear from Mufi more about his energy plan. I know he's talked about connecting the islands up and as well as geothermal and public-private partnerships. So I'd love to hear more about that.
All right. Thanks, Cole. I want to ask you, too, in looking at this and in looking at your energy plan, you also talk about looking at the utility, looking at HECO. Well, a lot of eyes have been on HECO, and a lot of people who have been trying to connect their solar systems to it and have not been able to because the grid is old and ever-aging. What do you mean when you say look at the utility? What do you want to see happen as that's comprehensively sort of audited?
Yeah. Well, let me state the problem as I see it. We pay electricity rates that are 300% higher than the rest of the nation. Of the $8 billion that we spend on energy every year, $6 billion of that is on oil. So we are very heavily dependent on oil. As much as we've tried to tout the clean energy initiative, we're still 85 to 90% dependent on oil and coal for our energy. So I've said that this is what I want to do. Number one, I want to upgrade the energy division to a full-on Department of Energy. Energy division is in the Department of Business, Economic Development, Tourism. I used to run that department. I'm very familiar with that. It needs more attention. It needs more resources. And it needs a better place in terms of people feeling that this is a department that speaks for our energy needs. Right now, it's an energy division. No different than when I upgraded the Department of, I should say, the Oahu Civil Defense Agency to a full-on department. And that made a world of difference at the county level for the Department of Emergency Management, because now that director sits at the table with the police chief, with the fire chief, with the head of medical services, and they really are in a position to speak as a cabinet member, a full-fledged cabinet member. And I want that department to be in charge of this new energy policy that's long overdue based on renewable energy. The second thing I want to do is give the PUC a broader mandate. And it begins with their special fund, Beth. They have a special fund every year of between $15 to $21 million. And guess what? The state raids that fund every year.
And we hear from them that they're understaffed, and we've heard that
exactly.
for a very long time.
And here's the thing. Even if they were to fill those staffing positions, they worked out of a cramped office space.
They wouldn't know where to put them. We've heard that part.
Exacto mundo. So what I'm saying is that upgrade that particular commission. It's very important. Give them a broader mandate so that they would incentivize those who come before them that are doing solar and wind energy and renewable energy. Have them push for a smart grid technology, and then also try to work with them so that their mandate or the way they set the rates is based on performance as opposed to a cost-based thing. If you do it on performance, that will ensure that renewable energy is going to be a priority. So I think that's very important. The third thing is that I'm a great believer in solar and wind, and I share in your frustration out there for people who have said they've continued to wait in line with no good answers from HECO of why it's taking so long for their solar permit applications to be processed. So I want to add to that mix, not only work with HECO, since they're the only utility company, to try to figure out why it is taking so long, but by the same token, I think the time is right now to talk about geothermal. And I'll tell you why. Even if we were to do all the solar and wind energy that we have the capability of doing in Hawaii, that only takes us between 35 to 40% of being totally renewable. Geothermal has the capability and the potential to maximize that to 100%. And I really believe now's the time to begin the conversation, especially on the Big Island, eventually Maui, because Maui's the only other island that has geothermal potential. In the community, we need to make sure that they're in a good place, that if there's a community benefits package that needs to be brought forth, I'd like to see that happen. Thirdly, the energy must benefit that host island first and foremost before we take it off and send it elsewhere, like to Oahu and the like. And I really believe it could happen now. You know, a few years ago, when I used to live on the Big Island back in the 80s, there was no one from the Hawaiian community that really supported geothermal, at least that I knew of.
In fact, it was the other way around.
Exactly. But now you have people running for OHA that support geothermal energy, and I think there's a greater understanding and appreciation of geothermal. And what I like about geothermal, it's a 24/7. Solar and wind are kind of intermittent, but geothermal is there the whole time. And so in the evening, you know, I'd like to harness that geothermal energy to power electric vehicles, or geothermal energy to be converted to desalinating our water system so that we can have the farmers and everyone use it. It's clean. It's efficient. I also believe that there is sufficient private sector interest, as I've seen with the 23 countries that have geothermal, the 8 states that have geothermal. There are over 700 projects that are being conducted in 76 countries around the world. I really believe the time has come for that.
Can I stop you there and just ask you a question? Because we've had sort of a love-hate relationship with geothermal over time. And there's also been the issue of, well, who owns it and who is going to administer it?
I want a private company to do that. And I want that private company to put up the $2 billion to build that plant. But I don't want the state to be totally out of that deal, if you will. I want the state to maintain an equity position. I want the state maybe to have a seat on the board so that it truly is a public-private partnership, because what's going to be critical to whoever that company is, whether it's GE or Siemens or some of these other major players, they want to know that government will have their back. And that's why it's important, because they need us for the permitting process. They need us for a community-based planning approach, because I don't want them going out there in the community on their own. And I want to do this collaboratively, too, with the governor, the mayors that are involved, county officials, state officials, and hopefully the community behind it. I really believe this is the only way that this is going to happen.
Well, we could do a whole hour on just geothermal, but because we have some callers and only in the interest of time, sure, we're going to move on a little bit. Going now to Rob calling us from Eva Beach. Aloha, Rob, and thanks for your patience. Rob, you need to turn down your radio there so we can hear you and you can hear us.
Yes, my question is, I heard him talking about the air conditioning issue, and I've been in some of the schools, and I agree, it's ridiculous that the state has not spent the money to air condition and update our schools. If, you know, our keiki that everybody talks about in Hawaii is such a big priority for us, why isn't the education forum a priority? And how would he address that?
All right. Well, we talked about that a little bit before. I mean, clearly you'd like to see those classrooms air-conditioned, but you're really talking about a big, sizable chunk of money to be able to do it. And even with just with 10 or so schools that are on the priority list, although we've talked to teachers and students to be able to do that, and they have a plan. What does your plan look like?
My plan is this. As the only one running for governor that's actually done an executive budget, I won't give the legislators a lot of wiggle room on this issue because I will put the funding in the budget when I send it down to them. And I will insist in working collaboratively with them before the session begins that this is my priority item. And I know you will have priority items too. So let's make sure that you don't cut the funding from this. And I will include what you want that may be on my B list in my budget because this has to be done. I think it's unconscionable to continue to study this problem, especially when the Department of Education has a priority list. So let's look at that priority list and let's chip it away at it, 3 schools at a time, 4 schools at a time, 5 schools at a time, whatever it takes, so that people know that we are serious about doing this and it's a major priority issue from the governor on down the community. You live out in Eva, and I tell you, I feel for those Campbell students and faculty and parents, you know, that make it a regular part of their visits to the state capitol to try to get air conditioners in. That's crazy. We should just do it, period.
All right. We're going to go now to Rachel calling us from Honolulu, and thanks very much for your call from Rob at Eva Beach.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank
go
you
ahead.
For taking my question. I was curious with all the conversation about budgets and what you'll do with them, what are your plans to access rapidly, like, while decreasing? They're probably going to go away if we don't use them, federal funds. So do you plan to leverage state funds so that we can access those federal funds that will soon be they'll just go away from us since we haven't used them?
Well, having had the opportunity and experience of dealing with federal funds as a county mayor, I've always said, you know, you need to use it or you're going to lose it eventually, or you're going to make it difficult to get federal funds in the future if you have a poor track record of using the federal funds. So this will require close collaboration with our congressional delegation because, after all, they often serve as the conduit for many of these federal grants. And then having a process in place where all the departments know that there's a certain amount of time that we have to use these federal funds, and I want them to use it wisely because we're going to go back again and ask for more federal funds for a particular program. And if federal funds comes with strings attached, then we've got to be really clear, if we accept it, what those strings are. I've always been one to not just say carte blanche, I want every federal dollar, especially if there's strings attached that we can't live up to or it would be difficult to implement here in Hawaii. So that's my feeling. Not every dollar that from the public that we are going to need has to come from state or county sources. If it can come from a federal agency, a federal department, and if it's going to other states and they're using it wisely, why not Hawaii? But we have to be very careful at times on the conditions that they attach to those federal funds.
Rachel, thanks very much for the call. We're going to go now to Daniel calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Daniel. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. How are you tonight?
We're doing well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Hanneman, I have a question for you, and I would like you to answer with some specifics, if you could, avoiding the vague generalities that I hear so often from politicians. What would be your specific policies or programs or efforts in reducing the percentage of Hawaiians or Hawaii residents that are on public assistance, SSI and food stamps, making them self-sufficient, not dependent on federal funding?
All right. Well, we like specifics, too. So thanks very much, Daniel, for the call.
Yeah. Well, let's look at two departments that can contribute immeasurably to helping Hawaiians. And I'm talking about the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, and I'm talking about the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. I really want to do a better job with the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. This is an area of great contention and controversy through the years, especially amongst Hawaiians, that somehow they're not processing the leases quickly enough, or when it comes time for a renewal of that lease, the insistence on a certain blood quantum makes it difficult. Or when they try to build a home, they're often told that there are strings attached in doing that. Here's the recommended list of contractors or developers that you must go to. We've got to streamline that. I want to do a management review of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands right from the get-go, because in Hawaii, it's all about your job, and it's all about cost of living, and it's all about putting a roof over your head. And I think that there are ways that we can run that more like a business as opposed to some of the favoritism that we've seen in the past. So that's number one. Get within the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Make sure that they are doing what they need to do to process those homestead lands out there to Hawaiians that can use it and are eligible for it, because that also will help us who are not Hawaiians and are competing in the rental market or the home ownership market. If we take more Hawaiians off that, then it makes it easier for non-Hawaiians to be able to rent homes or to own homes in that regard. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is another area that I believe that we can help them with. There are a lot of grants that are administered through the Office of Hawaiian Affairs that speak to job training, to workforce development, and the like. And one of the things that I'm really concerned about is they want to build Makai of Kaka'ako. If you've been to Kaka'ako here in Honolulu, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's now being inundated with a plethora of luxurious high-rise condos, and they're putting the Office of Hawaiian Affairs in a very untenable position because they're trying to give them the same opportunity to build luxury condos, Makai of Kaka'ako. I don't think that's the place to go. If we need to generate revenues for Office of Hawaiian Affairs, I'm interested in seeing if we can do something Mauka of Kaka'ako, where we should have more affordable housing and the like. So I want to work with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, give them an opportunity to maximize their revenues so they can help Hawaiians in that regard. The other thing that I'm very interested in helping, too, is the cultural immersion schools, the charter schools that have a lot of interest from Hawaiian children, Hawaiian parents, because of the fact that it allows them to perpetuate and preserve their culture. Oftentimes, they are underfunded. And if we're talking about education being the key to the future, then I think we have to make sure that they have the adequate resources to be able to do the job that they do so that they can graduate according to standards that we set for all our students, but then go to the next level. Hopefully it'll be a 2 or 4 year college, and then graduate with a degree and ready to be in the workforce so that they can be employable.
But you're really talking about the confluence of three things: housing, school, and health, access to health care.
Right. And I really believe, too, that it's important that we recognize that there are opportunities to help, not necessarily always looking to government to provide that funding. We have philanthropic foundations that give a lot of money to people of Hawaiian ancestry. We have scholarships and grants. And all those things I'd like to highlight and demonstrate that, you know, our Native Hawaiian people are very deserving of this. And certainly they should have every opportunity for every government grant, private assistance, philanthropic foundation grant to enable them to reach their full potential.
Our number is 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, use that one. And if you're calling us from Maui or the Big Island or Kauai or someplace else where you're listening to the live stream, it's 877-941-3689. Going now to Brianna, calling us from La'ie. Aloha, Brianna. Thank you for your patience.
Aloha. Thank you for taking my question. Being a young person in Hawaii and very interested in the future of it, mentoring, I know, is a big part of what leadership is all about, and I want to know what Mufi, as governor, is going to do and how he prepares the next generation of leadership for Hawaii.
I've always been big on mentoring, Brianna. You know, every year, I do 40 to 45 scholarships to public school students, or I should say I visit 40 to 45 schools. I give scholarships. I give book awards. I do read-to-me's. And I always take a talented female basketball team to the mainland, all about getting college scholarships and the like. So I really believe that our youth here in Hawaii are deserving of a lot of scholarships and opportunities to do well. Having said that, I also mentor a program called the Pacific Century Fellows Program. For 14 years, we have had that. And that's all about making sure that our young people are already developing solutions to the challenges that we have here. And the alumni of the Pacific Century Fellows include the president and CEO of Bank of Hawaii, Peter Ho, and a United States Senator in Brian Schatz. So I think that's very important, the mentoring aspect. But here's my real goal. You know, I want to make sure that anyone who graduates from Hawaii is going to be eligible for a job in the Pacific Asian region. This is where the rest of the country is now tilting or shifting its focus, if you will. And Hawaii should be at the forefront. Hawaii should be a showcase. Hawaii should be a model. And if you have a governor that understands that, then it doesn't matter whether you graduate from the University of Hawaii or one of the private institutions that we have here, be it BYU Hawaii, Chaminade, Hawaii Pacific, or the community colleges. A governor with that kind of reach into the Pacific Asian area, what I want to do is help you do what I've done in my private sector career as a consultant. Take the knowledge that you know, take the expertise that you have, and if you speak that foreign language in the Asia-Pacific region, you know, market that expertise out there. They're going to need expertise and help in a various areas of discipline that we're very good in Hawaii. And, you know, we'll develop a cadre of people that will help the knowledge-based industry so that when they're looking for assistance and help, it's not always to Japan, Australia, New Zealand, or California. They'll look to Hawaii. Conversely, I want to be that bridge for the United States to do business in this part of the world, or vice versa. And I think if we develop this pool of talented people that graduate from here, have a passion and interest in making sure that Hawaii is a better place, understand the Pacific Asian region, we really are going to be seen more than just sun, sand, sea, and surf, and spirit of aloha. I want that next S to be science and technology. I want us to be known for other things here and be able to grow through the years, and people will know that we have a talented group of people every year that graduate from here or local that go to school on the mainland but want to come back home and be part of this most dynamic region in the world, the Pacific Asian Basin.
She talked about mentoring as a start, and you took it off and looked at jobs elsewhere, not necessarily in Hawaii, but with those who are trained in Hawaii, able to go elsewhere and then possibly able to come back again. That's a little bit of a different conversation than we've had in past about creating jobs here that keep kids here.
I think we can do both, Beth. But I think that everybody has an idea for doing it here. What I'm trying to do is also say there's another way of looking
well,
at it.
Well, and that was my question right. That I didn't quite get out, is that the fact that we tend only to look myopically at what happens in Hawaii and can we maintain those who are born and raised in Hawaii and provide jobs for them here. The idea that there really is a world of opportunity, and not to, you know, hit that phrase too hard, but just that there are ways of being able to create some commerce with Hawaii and other nations in the world that would be providing jobs that are trained for right here in Hawaii. That's a little bit of a different conversation. Do you think that conversation happens enough with some of our young people? Because what we hear from them is, I can't stay home. I can't find a job here, as if here would be the only place that they could be, even if they want to be here. It's not necessarily feasible that you can stay in a place.
Well, I think what I'm trying to do here is create a much more global vision of what we're all about. We always say Hawaii is a special place. We have special people. And yes, we would like for them to reside here. But I think those that have the ability that speak a foreign language, those that have the ability to tap into an industry that needs expertise from people outside of their area, then look to Hawaii is what I'm saying. And if the person can travel there, is comfortable living there, why not? Because Hawaii will always be home. We'll always be drawn back here. But I think what in doing that, they also make sure that the rest of the world knows that we're more than a sun, sand, sea, and surf and spirit of aloha place. We're capable of putting out our smarts out there, our mana'o, our knowledge, and then hopefully we can draw them back here too by saying that came from Hawaii, from this particular industry, and you need to export more people from here to do those kind of jobs, or it could be a product. It could be a delicacy that we have here. It could be technology that emanates from Hawaii that they'll say, it comes
from
Hawaii.
But you're talking about innovation centers and expertise that are grown here that can go elsewhere, that create a different sense of cachet for Hawaii in a way that perhaps we haven't had in past. We've got lots of callers on the line. I want to try to get to at least a couple of them before we have to say goodbye. Lauren calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Lauren. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I think you sort of started to talk a little bit about, you know, what I wanted to ask, but I was just wondering if you could maybe offer a little bit more specifics as to, you know, how you propose to create the high-wage job opportunities that eventually, you know, whether it's people graduating from college here can enter into directly, or, you know, to attract to our expatriates that are making a living abroad.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons why, and I'm going to touch on another controversial project now, one of the reasons why I pushed rail is I felt that there was a wonderful opportunity to bring those engineers home, those who are very familiar with how to develop this type of project, because they've done it on the mainland, they've done it in a foreign country. And I've heard from a lot of folks that there's a lot more interest now in coming back to Hawaii, because if that was your field of expertise, you just knew you couldn't do that in Hawaii. So that's what I'm talking about. You know, you can identify industries here that will bring people. But I also want to look at it the other way in terms of exporting our professional consulting expertise abroad.
I think that's okay that we create that kind of talent pool to export.
Exactly. And this is where I see a governor who has that kind of capability, who has that vision, has that track record, will be very ideal to do this, because he's done it in the past and can do it in the future.
Lauren, thanks very much for the call. Going now to Mary calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Mary. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Kaka'aka was mentioned, and getting people off government assistance was mentioned. But, you know, all the jobs and education in the world for our local people are not going to be able to overcome an excessively high cost of living for lack of affordable housing. So what do you propose, Mufi, to do about this latest trend that we're seeing of multi-million dollar condominiums going up that nobody local is ever going to buy while we continue to struggle to get housing for our own people?
Let me answer your
question. Mary, thanks very much for the question.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, at this point, we'll take one question from her. But we talked a little bit about this at the beginning of the show. So if you want to just encapsulate
that
would be good.
That's why I'm the only candidate saying give Kaka'aka back to the city and county of Honolulu. You know, that's the only way I believe that we're going to bring in greater controls in terms of curbing this excessive approvals of luxurious high-rises. Three things. Number one, the city has a higher threshold for affordable housing. It's 30%, as opposed to what the Kaka'aka Authority will give you based on what you negotiate. Secondly, the rail line is coming through Kaka'aka. Tremendous incentive for affordable housing because of transit-oriented development where people can live and work along the transit line. And thirdly, you'll have an elected body making decisions for Kaka'aka as opposed to a governor-appointed authority that often has the perception that if they play ball for the governor, they'll have the approvals. That's why I want to see it go back to the city, the state and city working together to ensure proper planning, zoning, and more affordable housing in Kaka'aka.
Mary, thanks very much for the call. Going now to Michelle calling us from Maui. Michelle, you there?
Hi, Lucy. Good evening. I just wanted to call and thank you for staying focused this election season on the issues and specific solutions and not negative campaigning. Today I came home and I had 10 8x11 mailers in my box, and every time I turn on my TV, I'm so disappointed with the negativity between the Republicans and the Democrats. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that, if that was a concerted decision you made early on.
All right, Michelle, thanks very much. We just saw today Neil Milner on Civil Beat wrote about the effect of attack ads and how to regard those. You've said you're not going to do attack ads. You're not going to do negative campaigning.
Yes, and we've already been commended by David Shapiro, who is someone that very observant through the years, respecting the community. He commended us for running a campaign where we're taking the high road and we're not engaging in negative campaigning. I think it's a sad commentary, especially when it comes from PAC groups on the mainland, but also I'm noticing there's a lot of organizations here at home that are engaging in that. It has no room in Hawaii, negative attack ads. You know, it should be based on ideas, experience, and qualifications. So, Michelle, that's what we're highlighting. We're not engaging in negative ads, and I think the people are real losers as a result of that, and it makes the politicians look really bad when they engage in that.
Thanks very much for the call, Michelle. One more thing that we have not talked about tonight, I know the hour is quickly coming to a close, is agriculture. We've known for years and have said for years we can't feed ourselves. We have to bring so much food in. I mean, ad nauseum that we hear that diatribe again and again. But doing something about it and doing it well, we've gotten sort of an argument co-opted now by pesticides and GMO, and still we're bringing in so much that we have to have. What is, in your mind, the plan that moves us from being able to have a conversation about how we really do need to feed ourselves, what support needs to happen for farmers of all stripes, and is there room in that conversation for somehow disentangling GMO issues and pesticide issues?
Yes. Number one, I have a deep background in agriculture, and I've lived on the neighbor islands, which is a major, major advantage over my competitors, because I'm saying the best years of agriculture, in my humble opinion, are ahead of us as opposed to behind us. And it begins with funding. Beth, do you know that the Agriculture Department gets less than 0.7% of funding from the general fund? That's pittance. That's an outright disgrace. They can't do their job, whether it's inspectors that need to be in the field, whether it's people that have to guard against the invasive species that are coming in, whether it's help with farmers who need land, long-term leases, or help with loans and the like, or making sure that they have water, making sure the technology that many of them are embracing with respect to aquaponics, or creating that balance that we need between GMO products or organic and the like. And the other thing at the end of the day is that we need to help market Hawaiian agriculture. And this is where government can play a great role, because farmers are so busy farming, trying to make ends meet. At the end of the day, if we can take advantage of this made in Hawaii, taste from Hawaii, you know, that will also take our farming to another level. So we need to grow more for here from energy, I should say from food security, but also make sure that farming and agriculture is a good livelihood and that government will be that partner in going forward. So I really believe that we can make that happen.
How do you see that partnership happening that's different from the Made in Hawaii that we see now and some of the efforts that have happened before that small time?
I see it happening by making a commitment to fund agriculture and taking it beyond the Rodney Dangerfield status that it has now. It's not regarded
not
as an
respect.
Equal. They're not getting respect. And that's the first thing that you have to do. And then work with organizations like the Farm Bureau and farmers, whether they be big farms and small farms, and let them know they have a place in this economy. We want them to be vibrant. We want them to grow. And government will be your partner.
Well, we're going to have to say goodbye to you now.
I know.
I saw you looking at that clock, realizing that the hour has slipped by. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Good to talk to you again.
Aloha.
And thanks to you for joining us tonight for Town Square. Next week, we'll be talking with Duke Iona. And tomorrow morning on The Conversation, we'll speak with Jeff Davis. In the meantime, have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow morning for The Conversation right here on HPR2. Take care. Aloha.